True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
When I got to the edge of the cliff face and looked down, you could see the two bodies. You don't want anybody around you when you're standing that close to that edge. On three sides of it, it's a sheer cliff, and it's certain death. We went out for a drive, and had stopped at several locations before coming to this one. I'd asked him if he'd been in that location before, and he told me no.
I reported it as an accident. That's what I was told by authorities, that Leanna and Eric had gotten too close to the cliff. And I had talked to some of the authorities, and some of the authorities had indicated that they thought it was kind of suspicious, but you know, they at this juncture in the game, it was an accident.
This is expected to be a call from Roger Brauberger to Bob Duke reference conspiracy to commit murder.
Hey, remember when we talked before about the $20,000 for killing your parents?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm thinking I might want that.
I had to see if there was any validity behind what I was saying.
Do you have any ideas about maybe how I could do it, or okay, so you would think it would be on like a Friday night?
A weeknight. They might be going to Salt Lake or something for a day.
For an alibi.
Yes.
A good time would be over the Martin Luther King holiday weekend. If they could kill them on Friday, they would have 3 days to be totally out of their alibi themselves. And no one would even begin to look for their parents until Tuesday.
I can get you in, too.
You can get me in? So it's just walk in and walk out just like it was, like I lived there, basically, then?
Yeah, the best thing to do would be when no one, be there when no one's there.
Right.
And then when they come in.
And then catch them off guard?
Gotta be together.
Okay.
Because my dad does have a gun in the house.
Hey, as far as, like, afterwards, like, getting paid, like, is there insurance on them or something?
There are many things going on there.
Okay, well, let me kick around $20,000 for a couple days and I'll get back to you.
I've had it with this whole thing. I'm tired of hearing about it.
Right.
If you did, we could probably up at another $5,000.
Okay.
But the key is ASAP. You're not talking about this, are you?
No. No, I haven't said a word to no one. Is there any way we can make it look like an accident? Like you did with your wife and kid?
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
And this is a podcast commissioned by Rosalie in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Thank you, Rosalie, for the commission and for the beer. It's a good one, right? She picked a good one?
She picked a good beer, yes.
Good. So in order to support our show, we're going to need a little help from our listeners to get us some good advertisers. So in order to find great advertisers, we'll need to learn a little bit more about you. So please go to podsurvey.com/brewery and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you a little bit better. Now that way we can show advertisers just how great our listeners are. Even if you've taken our podcast survey before, this one is specific, so we'll really need you to take it in addition to that. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you're actually going to be entered into a contest to win a $100 Amazon gift card. So again, that's podcastsurvey.com/brewery, B-R-E-W-E-R-Y, and thank you so much for your help.
$100 gift card. I'll fill it out.
I know, right?
Yeah.
You'll do anything for $100.
Well, most anything.
Yeah, within your set of standards or morals.
Okay.
Okay. On a high, jagged cliff overlooking the Flaming Gorge Reservoir in Green River, Wyoming, a young mother and her 5-year-old son plunged to their deaths. Their bodies from rock to rock until they landed splayed and bleeding in the dust. Bob Duke's accounting of his family's death was really heartbreaking. He described a sudden scream. He'd raced to the edge of the cliff to the site of the twisted bodies of his wife and his small child below. He spoke of the agony of hearing his son's last breath as he tried desperately to reach him. The rescuers wept as the 23-year-old husband and father stood beside them in silence. This had to be a tragic accident. You see, Bob Duke was an upstanding young man. He was well-respected, successful. Any secrets in his past were well behind him. He was free to move forward and create a new life, and that would have been the end of it. Except it wasn't. Bob Duke had acquired a taste for something evil that would lead to his own downfall. Join us at the quiet end, if you will, to discuss the victims and the man behind these horrific deaths. In this episode, A Taste for Murder, the deaths of Liana and Eric Duke. Now, first, as always, I want to thank some 5-star reviewers. So thank you, Leslie Hansen, S at MMM, Designs by Prim, JP Girl 1903, Remy Riot, Before the Deluge, Drozer A 81, Disco's Cargo, Crazy Whacker, Farmer Jean, Greg H, and of course Tea Biscuit.
Tea Biscuit.
Yes.
A good one.
Not Sea Biscuit, but close.
Tea.
Tea Biscuit.
Not sea.
No.
So is it a horse?
No, it sounds more like something you're going to have at tea time. It must be an English person.
I see.
That's the way I see it.
Okay. I guess I'm just thinking too much of horse racing.
Yeah. What did you bring us for beer that was recommended by our commissioner, Rosalie?
Rosalie likes Melvin IPA.
I like the name.
So, and this is Melvin Brewing in Jackson, Wyoming. It's an American IPA. Haven't done one of those recently. So just to refresh ourselves, these are beers that are pale gold to red amber in color, tend to be herbal or citric hops for the hop profile, and they tend to be fairly balanced in terms of the hops versus the malt background.
Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty important. Hanging around you for a while, I've noticed that that's important.
Well, there are people that like the overly hopped ones that just blow your taste buds all to hell.
All right, palate wrecker.
Yeah.
And what's the one in Vermont? Heady Topper. That's super hoppy.
Yeah, there's a lot of hoppy ones. And I think all of us beer drinkers go through a stage where we seek out the holy grail of hops.
Sure.
And then most of us get to a point where we need to have some more balance. And this Melvin IPA is. So Melvin is a bright copper color with just a finger of khaki head that retained well, left some lace. Has a pine aroma, earthy aroma, a little bit of citrus. Taste is mostly grapefruit and pine. There's some late bitterness, and it's a nice medium-bodied beer, very balanced. So we've got the sweet malt and the hops.
Good choice, Rosalie.
Yeah, you did well. This is one of those good beers from Wyoming.
Okay, let's open it up.
Okay.
Okay, let's head down to the quiet end, and then maybe we'll go back to the noisy end, because looks like there's good stuff going on at the noisy end tonight.
Some sort of beer tasting or something, huh?
They're passing out little things of beer, so yeah.
Yeah. I wonder which brewery it is.
I don't know.
Well, we'll have to. I think you're right. We'll do this, and then we'll check it out.
Yeah, let's do it, and then we'll head on down to the noisy end for a change,
yeah, we'll do the quiet end first.
Yes.
So we can do our show.
That's right.
And then let's go drink some more beer.
Well, I never have heard such a good idea before.
Drinking beer?
Yes.
Little 4-ounce samples?
Yeah, it's because great. They can't hurt anything, right?
Well, unless you drink 10 of them.
Right. Well, that's what we have Uber for.
That's right.
Yep. All right, let's get on to the quiet end first, though, because we have a show to do.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. Now, Roger Brauberger and Bob Duke grew up together in the small town of Green River, Wyoming. They were different kids, but they were close friends. They spent afternoons at a mutual friend's house, whose father was a policeman, and many nights they'd sit home watching murder-for-hire and horror-type movies. The violent cult film Faces of Death was a favorite. They would joke about becoming hitmen themselves. Now, as they got older, Roger started to get into some trouble. He was experimenting with drugs and doing some petty crimes. But Bob, he was straight-laced. He was the kind of kid that parents loved. Kind of like, what was the guy on Leave It to Beaver?
Who, Wally?
Eddie Haskell.
Yeah.
The friend. Wally was the big brother.
Wally was the brother.
Yeah, so he was a bit of an Eddie Haskell type. The parents loved him.
Yeah, kind of a scamp.
Well, we didn't know that, though. He seemed totally straight-laced. Not a scam.
Oh, Eddie?
No, Bob. Stay with me here.
Oh, yes.
Bob Duke.
I got it.
Okay. Now, Bob's parents were school teachers. And Bob and Roger grew up a few blocks from each other. Roger in a little brown ranch house on Arizona Street. And Bob in a little red house on Bridger Street. So they went to school together. They went and they shot pool together. And they had some really big dreams that they were dreaming together as well. Now, Bob was the most ambitious kid of the group that they went to school with. He spoke constantly about his big plans for the future. He was very ambitious, with plans for college and some high earnings. He talked of college, of getting rich, and of traveling far from where they were. In Green River, he wanted to really make a name for himself.
He had big plans.
He did. He wanted to travel. He wanted to get away from the small town life. Now, Roger admired him. He was always so focused, so sure, and nothing ever seemed to rattle him. Bob would set his mind to something, and he would master it completely. For example, when the two guys took up Taekwondo together, Bob became a black belt. Roger, on the other hand, dropped out after a few classes. Now, Roger also dropped out of school in the 11th grade. He preferred to spend his time drinking, fighting, smoking pot, and even dropping a little LSD. It kind of progressed to that point. Now, he had a reputation as a criminal with little motivation. He was really going nowhere. Roger was often compared to his friend Bob, which kind of he didn't like, right? Because he never came out on top of that.
No. But, you know, most of us have had friends like this.
Like Bob or like Roger?
Well, the two of them. I mean, there's you know, you have these kind of best friends, and there's one who's more the straight arrow type and one who's more the fuck-up.
But they seem to kind of feed off each other. They like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right about that.
No, I had a friend named Joey.
Okay.
7th, 8th, 9th grade. And he was a classic.
Roger?
Roger.
Okay.
And I, of course, was a straight-laced.
Well,
Bob.
You didn't have to tell me, I knew.
But yeah, and we enjoyed each other's company.
See? So you can kind of live vicariously through each other in the different realms, right?
Right.
Yeah, I can see that. So when Roger dropped out of school in the 11th grade, he preferred to spend his time hanging out. And then Bob's dreams of a life beyond the small town of Green River... just kept growing, you know. He was polite, he was law-abiding, and he was working hard. He worked jobs, he got good grades. He was on his way to what he wanted to be.
He was planning on college?
Yes.
Somewhere. Yeah. He was getting out of Green River.
That's right. That was his plan. But then Bob's dreams of a life beyond Green River were quashed when his 17-year-old girlfriend, Leanna Davidson, got pregnant. So they're still in high school, of course, but Leanna's really pretty. She's shy, she's a brunette, and she's been dating Bob for a while. So there's some pressure by their parents. And Bob and Leanna marry in May of 1991. Now their son Eric was born only 3 months after their wedding.
Well, she was pregnant.
Right, so that's the way it works.
Yeah.
So Bob, he got a job as a carpet layer, which might not sound like much, but he did really well at it. He was a hard worker, and he built a reputation as the best in the business in the whole county of Sweetwater. He was reliable, he was diligent, he had a really professional image. He also seemed to be the perfect husband for Leanna. He provided well for her and the baby. He spent time with his son. Even if he did seem a bit cold and standoffish, you know, they thought that's just Bob's way.
Well, one might say that, but others might say that's a red flag.
They might, but there are some people that are like that and never go on to commit any crimes that we know of.
True.
Right?
But here you've got this guy who's this hard worker, who apparently loves his wife and his family, but he's kind of cold.
A little bit.
Yeah. I mean, okay.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
That's not grounds for divorce. You can't call the police.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's something that you look at in hindsight and say, you know, this was something that was a worry.
A little bit. So Bob started envying his friend that was having fun. And Roger envied his friend Bob with the perfect home and the perfect family. Because Bob always had money in his pocket. He always had jobs coming around. So even though he's you know, hasn't gone to college. He's still successful. Like, he's going to make something of himself, pull himself up by the bootstraps, as they say.
Well, there's the old story. Hard work gets you success.
That's right. So Roger thought, someday I'd like to settle down and have a home and a family as well. Now, when he was 21, Roger bought Duke a gun, a 9mm Beretta. Roger was older by just a few months, so he was legally able to make the purchase for Bob. And he also had some connections, not good ones, connections that Bob didn't have, to people who were dealing in drugs, in guns, and in small-time crime. Now, years later, Roger would regret his choices, and he would try to improve his life. Years later, he would regret that he ever strayed into a world that had tarnished him, and it kind of gave him a reputation that he felt he didn't deserve. He ended up with this reputation that was going to haunt him when he finally would try and do the right things in his life. Now, Liana, she became a devoted homemaker. She filled their modern apartment with homemade crafts and inexpensive knickknacks. One of her aspirations was to own her own craft shop one day. So through these early years, Bob maintained a friendship with Roger Brauberger. So they were, like we said, they were kind of complete opposites, but still pretty close. And Roger was getting this reputation as a lowlife, which he couldn't seem to get away from. And Liana started to disapprove of Bob's relationship with Roger. She thought he should hang around a better type of person. And Roger seemed really rough to her. He was tattooed, he had piercings, he was a smoker and a pretty heavy drinker. And also, Roger had drug-dealing friends, and he was known to sling a little pot or pills himself. Now, at Liana's urging, the friendship kind of waned, but Bob still hung out with Roger. They had the occasional guys' night on the town, or the two would go off-roading in his pickup truck, which is something people do out in the country.
Right.
Get in your pickup truck and, I don't know, what's the attraction? You drive through the mud.
I don't know the attraction either, but that's because I'm an Easterner.
Right. But it's something that people do.
Right.
Right. Now, Bob was starting, though, to spend more time with his cop friend. He worked out, he went fishing, and he took martial arts classes with the other guy. Roger heard about Liana and Eric's deaths from his mother. So Roger's mother called him while he was away in Laramie helping a friend move, and when he heard the news, his stomach just sunk. Roger listened in disbelief with panic and disgust rising in his throat.
So according to Bob Duke, his wife and son had fallen off a cliff to their deaths. Turns out that Bob, Liana, and Eric had all piled into Bob's Jeep and set out for a family outing. They'd stopped on a ridge overlooking the Flaming Gorge Reservoir. They all got out of the Jeep. 5-year-old Eric threw rocks, chased lizards, with Liana by his side, the attentive mother.
And she was attentive by all accounts, very doting mother.
Well, and we've seen pictures of this place.
Yeah.
This is, I wouldn't go up there.
No.
Of course, I hate heights anyway, but yeah, I would certainly, if I'm up there with my family, I'm going to stick right next to my little 5-year-old.
But who's going to let their 5-year-old go out and play there? There were snakes. It was slippery. There was gravel. It's very suspicious.
It is.
Yeah. It's not a place to take your kid.
Well, as we shall see.
Right.
So Eric was throwing rocks. He was chasing lizards. Mom was by his side. Bob says he went to the car to get a soda. While his back was turned, he heard his wife scream his name. He turned around, and they were gone. Boom. In an instant.
Right.
Blink of an eye. Sheriff's Department Lieutenant named Kevin Alvesteffer had arrived at the top of the cliff. He talked to Bob, and he felt quite puzzled.
It's a puzzling scene.
It is. It's a towering ridge. I mean, this TV probably doesn't even do it justice, but it looks like a straight drop-off. A couple hundred feet. So they had fallen about that distance, 200 or so feet, into the rocks below. And at the top, Lieutenant Alvesteffer met the young husband and father of the victims, Bob Duke, who was appropriately distraught.
Was he, though? Not really.
He was.
He was? Well.
To begin with.
Well, I guess. If he thought he was in shock, but he wasn't really crying or freaking out like I would expect a person to do.
No, he wasn't doing that. He was quiet and, I would say, in shock.
Well, if you're giving him the benefit of the doubt, he was in shock.
I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Or he could have been cold. And that's what they did. Which was a red flag before that he was a cold guy.
So the policeman worked his way cautiously across the ragged, loose shale. And this is all stuff, I mean, you take a step and you slide.
Terrifying to me as a person with a fear of heights.
Yeah. I'd be crawling on
I'd
my
be
stomach.
Crawling, and I could never take a child up there.
So three sides of this was sheer cliff. So you fall off of there 200 feet down, you're going to die.
Of course. Certain death.
Bob Duke told Alva Steffer he had not been able to get down there to see if his wife and child were alive or dead because it was too steep. Odd, thought the cop, the first responders had made it down quite easily. So even though it's a fairly steep drop-off, there, I guess, a way to get down fairly easily.
Right. There's a way to the side where you can climb down.
Cop watched Bob as the lifeless bodies of his wife and child were hoisted up the cliff. He seemed unaffected. So this is where you're starting to get some suspicion. I mean, maybe initially you're thinking, the guy's in shock, his wife and kid just died.
Well, I think initially you think that because your mind's not going to go right to something
but now
sinister.
You bring them up and he's not showing much emotion.
No, he's not going over to them. He's not saying, please save them. It's abnormal.
Right. And the policeman wondered why Bob had parked his Jeep on this particular cliff, such a dangerous place, with his wife and his 5-year-old.
Good question.
The idea that a parent would allow their child to play at such a place seemed preposterous.
Yes.
No kidding.
Yes.
Again, I keep coming back to what we saw in the documentary.
Yeah.
This is just a terrifying place, and I'm saying that because I hate heights anyway.
Yeah, but you're not going to take a 5-year-old to something like that.
No, I mean, they're rambunctious kids. They're all over the place.
And this was a timid child.
Anyway, Bob said they went out for a drive and had stopped at several locations before coming to this one. Lieutenant Alva Steffer asked him if he'd ever been in this location before, and Bob said he hadn't. But even if he'd never been there before, couldn't he see the risk?
I would think so.
Wouldn't you?
Yes.
But Bob and Liana were young, early 20s. And if they were foolish enough to let their child play on the cliff top, it was reasonable that Liana would have reached out to save her son and then slipped off herself.
Sure, but it's a stretch to me that she would even let her child out there.
Yeah, I mean,
a big stretch.
She's an apparently conscientious mother.
Yeah, she's not crazy.
And this looks like a place you wouldn't want to wander around as an adult, much less a 5-year-old.
No, very bad place.
Very.
Now, even if investigators believed Bob's story, so let's say they believe his story, his childhood friend Roger, he knew that this wasn't an accident. Liana was an overprotective mother, he said. And Eric was a timid boy. He was afraid of bugs, and he was too timid of a kid to be out playing near a cliff.
So this is totally out of character.
Yes. And anyone who knew Liana knew that she wouldn't let her kid play there. They knew it was just really weird. But then also at the same time, no one really thought that Bob could have done anything. So it was just weird. It left people kind of puzzled, except for Roger.
Yeah, because Roger had some info.
He did. He had a reason to be very suspicious. And he was really emotionally torn up when he heard about this. Of course, he knew Liana and Eric, and he knew Liana as a sweet and loving young mother, and Eric as a cute little kid. Very innocent, of course. He's 5. Who's not innocent at 5?
Pretty much everybody.
Everybody's innocent at 5, yeah. So there was something haunting Roger, something that only he and Bob knew. About 1 month earlier, Bob had approached Roger with a proposition. He'd asked Roger if he would kill his wife and child for money. Yeah.
Whoa.
Roger thought Bob was just blowing off some steam. Until a few weeks later, Bob actually laid out a detailed plan to him. So Bob said, "Have you given any thought to that? How about $20,000? And here's what he had for a plan. He said, "I'll be barbecuing this Wednesday. I'll leave the rifle behind the shed, and you can shoot me in the arm, shoot my wife and kid in the head and chest, and then take out as many neighborhood kids as you need to, just to make it look not too obvious."
Well, that's a pretty well thought out plan.
So he's beyond cold.
I guess. And you notice how he said, "Shoot me in the arm." That's the favorite place for people that are trying to disguise the fact that...
Isn't it, though?
Yeah, we've had enough of this.
Yeah, Diane Downs was shot in the arm.
Yeah.
Bart Whitaker shot in the arm.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing to do, which is really stupid. You know, that's the thing with, who was the guy in Boston? At least he shot himself in the abdomen.
Yeah,
he
Chuck Stewart.
Put a little effort into it.
Well, I think he messed up. He didn't want to shoot himself in the abdomen as well as he did, because he almost died.
But he still didn't get away with it. So
no,
he let
still
that
didn't.
Be a lesson.
No. Don't go shooting yourself in the arm, because you're going to get caught every time.
Yeah. If you survive and everybody else dies, you're the suspect.
Right.
So just don't do it. Cut the shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just live with it. You don't like somebody, divorce them, leave them, right? There's no reason for this. This is just total horse shit.
It is.
Yeah. And this is according to a doctor, so you need to listen. So
he picks his friend Roger because he's a, you know, kind of a low-life scumbag who would have the means to do the murder.
Right.
And probably the opportunity.
Right. But it turns out Roger really isn't the scumbag here, which is what I like about this story.
Roger has found reformation.
I like this story because I like the fact that someone who's looked at as kind of a fuck-up might have the higher moral ground and might do the right thing. And that
I think it's very interesting.
Does my heart good to hear that. So Roger says to Bob, you know, this is just crazy, dude. But Bob looked very serious. Now, he knew that Roger was into drugs, and he probably figured that Roger was the last person on earth who would go to the police. That's why he chose him.
Sure.
Now, Roger, he wondered what had happened to that family that Bob would suggest killing them. I mean, they seem like a happy family. Roger asked him why he didn't just get a divorce if he was unhappy. And that's a good question, right?
Well, it's an easy question to ask.
Yes.
But these guys, and I say guys because it's pretty much always the husband.
Usually.
They don't look at it that way.
Well, I don't understand.
They have this really skewed view that they don't want to pay any money.
Crazy.
Whether it's alimony, child support, or what. So they would rather run the risk of being convicted of murder than to pay out money.
That's just stupid. That's very stupid.
It's fantastically stupid.
Yeah. And narcissistic and sociopathic.
Right. And that's why they end up doing what they're doing.
I mean, how many men have done this? A lot.
We've had a lot.
A lot of men could have just got a divorce and been living fine, and they're in prison.
Yep.
And the poor woman is dead.
See? So you think, okay, do I want to pay, I don't know, $1,000 a month child support plus alimony? Or do I want to kill him and go to jail?
Right.
And they took the opposite, or the latter.
Well, I think the ones that do it have an ego where they think, oh yeah, I can get away with it.
Oh, sure.
And of course they have no empathy for the person they're killing. That goes without saying. So what Bob had said to Roger, though, that is that he didn't get a divorce because his parents would hate him if he did that. But I guess his parents would be okay if he murdered her?
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't make sense. And then he said he'd have to pay some child support. Well, ain't that a shame, as they say.
Well, it's his kid.
How do you kill your own child, too? That's something really wrong with him.
Not just that. How do you kill your own kid to avoid child support?
Yeah.
Jesus.
That's really bad. So Roger had considered going to the police at that point, but he ultimately didn't, and he would always feel guilty for that.
Yeah, there's a little chink in his reformation project. He has his info.
Yes.
He ought to have gone to the cops.
He ought to have had. Does that make sense? He ought to have had? Yeah, he should have. But he didn't because he didn't think they'd believe him. I mean, he's the scumbag.
Yeah, I know.
They and wouldn't. Bob's the good guy.
Yeah.
Also, do you really take that seriously? It'd be hard to take that seriously.
Well, I guess it would. Until it actually happens. I mean, he's talking about, can you kill my wife and kid? And he's thinking, this is just some guy blowing smoke at me.
Sure.
But then they die.
Well, yes, at that point, I'm with you. Yeah.
Under some fairly mysterious circumstances. So I got to be thinking, he did it.
Oh, sure. But I was thinking before they died, maybe he should have said something to save them.
Well, no, I would...
That's what he felt guilty about,
yeah,
I think.
I'd go back to what you were saying earlier, that he didn't believe that he was serious.
Right. What would the police have done at that point?
Right.
Probably nothing. But then if he'd told the police and then they ended up dead, that might set off a light bulb. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
But he didn't say anything. And then it was just weeks later that Liana and Eric were dead. Now, Bob had figured out a way to make it look like an accident. And Roger knew he had a moral obligation to speak up to say something. But he felt like, well, it's my word against Bob's, and Bob's word is going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So Bob had a reputation as a really good guy. He was actually a pillar of the community. Roger's own parents absolutely loved him. When Roger went and told his own dad that Bob had offered him money to kill his wife and kid before he did it himself, his dad actually didn't believe him.
Yeah.
So if your dad doesn't believe you, are the police going to believe you? Good question. Probably not.
Probably not.
So.
And here's this druggy guy.
Yep.
Not reliable.
Right.
Coming up with this kind of fantastic story.
Sure. Although it was a little bit of a hinky story. There was some weirdness about the story.
Yep.
So I kind of think maybe it would have been given some consideration. But obviously Roger didn't think so. Also, Roger didn't have any real proof that Bob had killed his wife and child. Roger thought that he would have looked like he was attacking someone that had just been through a personal tragedy, and he decided he better keep his mouth shut. So he did have a hard time living with that, though, and he was actually a pallbearer for Bob's son, knowing deep down that Bob had killed the little boy.
Or at least having a really strong suspicion.
I think he felt pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
he didn't know for a fact.
No.
That he killed.
He didn't have any proof. So no, I guess you're right. Now, before the funeral, Bob actually took Roger aside. So this was a little suspicious too, because Bob said to Roger, "I need to know that you believe I didn't do this. I need to know whether I have to cover my ass on this." Now, how would you take that?
Well, there's only one way to take it.
Sure.
He did it.
So you would. Well, what if he was just coming to you to say that because the accident had happened and he didn't want you to go around thinking he'd done it? It could be taken that way.
I suppose it could, but I'd be thinking, here's this guy that had already asked me to kill them, and he's talking this type of stuff after the fact.
Right.
He did it. That's what I think.
Yeah. Well, Roger was kind of intimidated, I guess, because he said, no, there's no way you could have possibly done this. Now, the conversation gave Roger a really sickening feeling, though. He found himself brooding over memories of Bob and the lack of warmth that Bob showed toward his son, and how Bob would kind of push his son aside when the child was excited to see his dad. Also, how Liana had been so obviously in love with Bob, and Bob didn't seem to share it. So he thought, how did Liana feel when she realized the man she loved was killing her and their son? And this idea really haunted him.
Well, it would.
So, since we're thinking about that, do you think that if Bob pushed them off the cliff, were they conscious and aware?
Of being pushed?
Yes, were they, or did he strangle them and then throw them over?
No, pushed them off.
So there had to be a realization for a second or two,
right,
of what was happening.
Certainly.
And how dreadful is that?
It doesn't get much more dreadful than that.
And I kind of feel like she wouldn't willingly even walk near the edge with their son. So how did he get her out there?
I don't know. I mean, I think if there had been more of a struggle, that he might have gone over too. So I think he somehow got them close enough to the edge that he could push them over.
Isn't that just awful?
Without struggling.
I guess.
Yeah.
But I still feel like the betrayal that she and the little boy would feel would be horrible, horrific.
Well, yeah, it would. I don't know how much time they had.
Well, a second or two is all it would take.
Yeah.
To feel that.
Well, the second or two is just to say, can't fucking believe my husband just tossed me over the cliff.
Right. And then as a mom, it's mostly going to be about the little boy.
Yeah.
That's going to break her heart.
Yeah, but those are going to be very brief moments before they hit the rocks below.
Sure, but does that make it any better? No.
Well, no, I guess.
No, it doesn't.
I guess not, although it doesn't give you a lot of time to think and dwell on what happened.
No, but it's still horrific.
Absolutely.
And I hope for her that she was way over the cliff before the boy went. Because just seeing your little boy go over the cliff would be the worst thing ever for a mother.
Wouldn't it?
Yes. So Liana and Eric were buried side by side on a hill overlooking the town, and Bob took really great care in choosing the headstones. He chose doves and flowers for Liana, and an engraving of a boy with a dog for Eric. Now Roger, as I said, was a pallbearer, and he carried Eric's small coffin. And of course he had a troubled mind and a sinking heart as he did this. Bob actually cried at their funeral, but as the town grieved and expressed their disbelief, there were also whispers of doubt. Still, people offered their condolences, of course. Now, the deaths were ruled an accident, and Bob did collect $60,000 in life insurance money. It didn't make sense that the young family had been in such a dangerous location, though, in the first place. And that's the big hurdle that I can't cross.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they probably wouldn't have been up there.
No.
Or if they were, they get out of the truck, the Jeep, and say, okay, I've had enough, let's go back.
Right. Now, after the funeral, Roger stayed away from Bob because, of course, he was uncomfortable. Although he did borrow money once from him for drugs. So Roger was a drug addict.
Yes, he was.
And nothing's going to stop a drug addict from getting their drugs, pretty much.
Not much.
But they no longer went off drinking and, you know, off-roading, that kind of fun stuff together. Because Roger just wanted to steer clear of them and kind of trying to put the whole thing out of his mind. A denial.
I mean, the friendship fizzled a little bit.
Sure.
And wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, here you are, Roger, thinking, my best friend killed his wife and child.
Right. So you don't want to be near him.
No.
Right. That's true. And I really feel like the friendship had been kind of waning for a while as Bob started to get more narcissistic.
Yes.
Because Roger didn't really abide with that. Whatever Roger's faults, that wasn't the way he rolled.
No, whatever his faults. And
they were many.
There were a few, yes. that wasn't one of them.
Right. He did have a heart.
So in the fall of 1998, Bob Duke moved to Houston. Getting out of Wyoming, he wanted to leave his past behind. Moved to live with his older brother, Mike. Roger felt some relief. He hoped to put the dark past behind him. So he's happy. He doesn't have to see Bob anymore.
Yes, he liked that.
And this Green River, Wyoming is a small town.
You
can't avoid seeing each other.
No.
Now, Roger rationalized that even if he went to the police, it wouldn't bring Liana and Eric back. He'd put it all behind him. Surely he thought Bob would never kill again.
That's a big mistake.
But then the phone calls began. The fear and guilt that had haunted Roger came back with a vengeance. Bob called Roger and wanted to know if he'd get him an automatic weapon. He was working in a security high-rise, and there were people that wanted certain people dead. And he could make money at this. So we're going back to the hitman fantasy back when they were teens.
Yeah, but Bob's, not fantasizing. He's, for reals.
I know, but Bob knew that Roger's drug-dealing friends had connections. He knew if anyone could help him out, Roger could. So Roger played along for a while, until Bob called a few weeks later with an even more disturbing request. He said to Roger, "Look, I've done family before. I didn't enjoy it, you know? I would like you to kill my parents."
So he didn't like killing them. Well, does that make you feel a little more sorry for Bob?
Doesn't it?
No.
Roger was shocked. Bob told him, "They're going to die whether you do it or not, but I know that you need the money, so I'm giving you a first shot at it."
That's nice of him.
Poor choice of words. He offered Roger $20,000 to kill his mom and dad. So Roger's just going nuts with this stuff.
Well, yeah. Roger's not a killer.
He's afraid. He's just shaking. He calls his father, and his father was equally stunned.
Yeah, his father really liked Bob. He thought Bob was someone that Roger should emulate.
Yeah, not anymore.
No.
He said, why would Bob do that? Roger told him it was for the money. Roger's father said, "Go right to the police and tell them everything you know." So Roger decided that for once in his life, he's going to do the right thing.
So go, Roger.
This is kind of the reclamation project of Roger.
Yes.
Because everything turns out to the better for him.
And it kind of, that's point. What appeals to me about this story, yeah.
He'd gone to school with a kid named Mark Meacham, and his dad was Detective Mont Meacham, who was the head of narcotics. And Roger felt this guy was someone he could trust.
Yeah.
So that's who he sat down and talked with.
Yep. So Mont received the call from Roger, and he says that Roger was in a total panic. He was rambling. He was frightened. He said, "They'll kill me. They'll kill me." So Mont went ahead and met with Roger. And after hearing everything from Roger on the deaths of Liana and Eric, and now Bob's plan to kill his own parents, Detective Meacham decided that Roger would have to do the one thing he thought he would never do in his life, and that was cooperate with the police.
Yep.
So he would have to record his old friend Bob plotting to kill. So the FBI was called in, and they put a tap on Roger's phone. And they needed Roger and Bob to discuss the plot, because up until that point, they only had Roger's word, and Roger's word versus Bob's word wouldn't necessarily win the day.
No.
So Roger, very nervous, went ahead and called Bob and recorded their conversations. And Bob wasn't shy about discussing his plans to have his parents killed for insurance money. His brother Patrick was in on the plot, too. Now, the plan was for Roger to lie in wait in the parents' home and catch them off guard when they arrived home. Roger tried to get Bob to admit to the murders of Liana and Eric over the phone, but Bob wouldn't go that far. So, for the safety of Bob's parents, the FBI decided that they should go ahead and arrest the brothers. So, Bob and Patrick Duke's parents, though this is the part that kills me, they refused to listen to the telephone recordings, and they refused to believe that their sons wanted them dead. Now, this is extreme denial.
Way extreme.
And it's not in their best interest.
No.
I mean, it's kind of sad. I don't really hold anything against them for doing it, but I think that's something you probably should have faced up to.
Well, if you have all this evidence to the contrary, yeah, wouldn't you think? Although,
I don't know. It'd be really hard, though, with your kids.
You know, they don't want to listen to the tapes. So all it is the police saying, your kids want to kill you.
Yeah. But wouldn't you want to listen to the tapes for confirmation?
Well, apparently not.
That would be a hard truth to face.
Yeah, so maybe they don't want to do that.
I guess. But more than a few people in Green River made it clear to Roger that they also agreed with Bob's parents, and they thought that Bob was innocent.
Huh.
Yeah, well, he has a good reputation, and Roger doesn't. So Bob Duke was charged with conspiracy to commit murder of his parents, but he was not charged with the murder of his wife and son, and he went ahead and took a plea bargain. So the sentence was just 10 years in federal prison. So by 2009, Bob Duke would be a free man. So now Roger, he's married, he has a baby, he has another baby on the way, and so he's in this position where he's terrified because he's thinking Bob's in prison. All he's thinking about is how he's going to get revenge on me when he gets out.
Oh, yeah.
So he asked the FBI for protection, but the FBI said, no, you don't qualify. So I don't know what the qualifications are, but it doesn't seem really fair because he did do the tapped phone.
Yeah, he's the one that got to this point.
Yeah, I mean, he's the one that helped get the conviction.
Yeah.
But he wasn't getting protection. So finally, prosecutor Harold Moneyhun and investigator Mike Dayton agreed to take a fresh look at the accident on the cliff that had killed Liana and Eric Duke back when they were supposedly having a family day and hanging out over on the cliff down on Lost Dog Road.
So the investigators knew that this would be a difficult case to prove.
It was a long shot, really. Right? Yeah.
So the investigator Dayton went out to the cliff. He was startled by the harsh wind, the rattlesnakes, and the severe drop.
Rattlesnakes, that part, you got me there.
Yeah. No thanks. This was no place for adults, let alone a child. The surface was thin, shifting shale with gravel on top of it. Layers of thin rock laid on layers of thin rock. Whenever he stepped, every step shifted a little bit. So, man, you're not going to feel comfortable. walking around there.
No, they say pictures and video doesn't really give you a true picture of how horrific it is.
No, it doesn't. But the precariousness of the spot wasn't enough. They needed forensic evidence. So they got a court order to exhume the bodies. The original crime scene photos were looked at and autopsies were performed. There is a linear mark and a bruise on Leanna's throat, and there is a suspicion that there may have been evidence of strangulation prior to her being pushed off the cliff.
Yeah, now if they could have proved that, that would have helped their case a lot.
Sure. The feeling was if Bob had strangled her, they were sure the hyoid bone, a small bone in the neck, would be fractured.
Yeah, but we've talked about that in other cases.
Right, but it wasn't. It was intact.
Right.
So she had not been strangled. They brought in an expert in the way things and people fall. Pardon?
A physicist?
No, it just says expert.
Oh, well, I think the way things fall, I think physics.
Well, I'm not sure why they thought that this was going to be a helpful thing.
Well, because I think if you jump off a cliff compared to being pushed, can't they tell?
No.
I thought you could because of the projection.
If it's simple physics.
Okay, well, give me a simple physics lesson.
A simple answer is if they fall or they're pushed, there's not enough velocity forward to make any difference.
What if you jump?
Would that make a velocity difference? The only thing that would make a difference is if they had a running head start and jumped.
Crazy. That'd be crazy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So whether they were pushed or fell, the physics are the same. You're going to drop at a certain velocity to the rocks below.
And so that didn't work?
Well, no.
Okay.
And I don't, to me, that's a pointless exercise.
Well, I guess it's because you're a scientist, because I would think, oh, yeah, sure, we could tell by that.
No, you
can't. As a layperson, that's what I'd think. Well, I would.
Yeah. Well, and even if you could do it, I mean, it wouldn't give you the answers you're looking for.
No?
No.
Okay.
So, but again, go
Never
back.
Never mind then, you just burst my bubble.
I'm sorry. But whether they fell or pushed or were pushed, the results are going to be the same.
Yes, and that's what they found out. But they went to a lot of effort to find that out.
Yeah, needless effort.
Okay, looking back, yes.
So again, just going back, if the mother and child had taken a running start and really jumped as far out as they could.
Yeah.
Which with a 5-year-old wouldn't be very far.
Right.
That's the only way that there might be some differences found.
Okay. So the pushing and the falling is the same.
Pushing and falling are essentially the same thing.
So this is really, and I hate to say this, but this is really kind of a smart way if you want to kill somebody. It's kind of a way where you might get away with it.
You could have. I mean, you just stick to your story.
Right.
I mean, now
so
this,
if he never had done the parent thing, he probably would have got away with this.
He probably would have. Definitely. I mean, there's no witnesses. And whether they fell off the cliff or pushed off the cliff, it's his word against whatever else.
What would be the whatever else?
The suspicion.
Oh, okay.
And you might be suspicious. I mean, because this wasn't a very hospitable place, and you're thinking, why would anybody ever be up there?
Yeah, but so, that's not enough. I don't think that's enough to make it a murder at all.
So you've got this semi-grieving husband and father.
Right.
Who says they fell. And you might be suspicious that they didn't really fall, but there's a very difficult way to prove that.
What's the difficult way to prove that?
Well, you can't, basically.
Right. Well, go ahead. Go ahead. We'll talk more.
So the investigators knew at this point that they weren't going to get a lot of additional forensic or physical evidence, right?
Right.
And they knew that their case would hinge on the credibility of Roger Brauberger.
Right.
So Roger was certain that Bob Duke had murdered his wife and child, but his reputation as a drug addict and drug dealer was pretty terrible. Who's going to believe him?
Yeah, but why would he make it up? There's really no motive for him to make it up either.
No, and I guess you have to stress that.
Now, actually, didn't the police make dummies in the same weight and everything as the mom and son and throw them over the cliff and try and recreate it?
I thought we covered that by saying that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but we didn't mention that the police did that.
Well, they did.
Yeah, and it didn't help them.
Not at all.
No, okay. They did decide to take the chance. 5 years after Leanna and Eric plunged off a cliff to their deaths, Bob Duke, father and husband, was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder. So by then, the general feeling among people in Green River was that it was about time he was charged. So that's the way the tide was turning. At the trial, rescue workers testified that Duke's demeanor was odd for someone who'd suffered such an unexpected tragedy. And I would agree with that.
Absolutely.
Now, Liana's family and friends said she was an overprotective mother who would never have let her young son play on that cliff. Others said that Bob was unhappy in his marriage, and he'd actually begun being kind of verbally abusive to Liana. So the prosecutor took the jury to Lost Dog Trail, which was very important so they could get a real feel for the area. Because like I said, seeing a picture doesn't really do it for you.
No, it doesn't.
So it was a windy, warm day in August. They drove in on a remote, winding road to the face of the cliff where Liana and Eric had fallen, and jurors walked cautiously along the ridge, and they were frightened by the harsh winds and the rattlesnakes and the steepness of the cliff, and they seemed silently shocked to see this deadly drop-off and to think that a mother would take her little boy there. Doesn't make sense. So the FBI tapes where Bob asked Roger to kill his parents were also played for the jurors. And then there was the most important witness, Roger himself. He would testify in a case that could put his old friend in prison for life. And Roger told the jury the specific details of how Bob had offered him $20,000 to kill his wife and his child, and how 3 years later he'd offered him a similar amount of money to kill his parents. The defense attorney smiled at jurors, explaining that it was all just a misunderstanding, a mistake.
Sure.
Bob Duke, a young husband and father, had tragically lost his family. Then he had been imprisoned over this stupid joke about his parents that had gone wrong. This case was about an overzealous prosecutor who was so determined to get a conviction that he was hinging his entire case on testimony of a witness with no credibility. So his testimony was just this dreamed-up story of a drug user and a drug dealer, this Roger Brauberger. So how could you base a case on someone that was so untrustworthy, right?
Well, I don't know that he was that untrustworthy, right?
Well, he was a criminal.
Yeah, that doesn't make him untruthful.
Well, no, but it might make him unreliable as far as knowing what's going on.
I mean,
he's in a drug haze.
Maybe you're thinking, okay, he's a druggie. He doesn't know.
I think a lot of people think that about people on drugs, sure.
But there was a revelation in the trial. So just when it seemed that the whole case would rely on Roger's testimony, a young woman named Crystal Robinson came to the prosecutor with an interesting story.
And this made the prosecutor very happy.
This is where it gets really good. When Bob Duke was married to Liana, Crystal had been his girlfriend. Bob used to drive her to the cliffs at the end of Lost Dog Trail where they would make out and drink beer. Or maybe drink beer and make out, whatever.
Why does the order matter?
I guess not.
Okay.
He told her over and over again that he wanted out of his marriage. When Crystal asked him why he didn't get a divorce, he said that he wanted to find a way out in which he wouldn't have to pay child support.
Well, what way would that be?
Well, let's kill him.
That's about it, really.
So here we have that. And I think she also had mentioned that they had been on that particular cliff.
Yes, well, that's an important part of it. So, that's where they would go, yeah.
So he knew the area, even though he had told the original detectives when the deaths occurred that he'd never been there before.
Yeah, so they caught him in a lie there.
Gotcha. So Bob Duke took the stand in his own defense in the final days of the trial. In a confident voice, he described the family outing which had turned into a tragedy when his wife and son had fallen off the cliff. He recalled hearing her scream and the sounds of his son choking out his last breaths on the rocks below. He defended the tapes about killing his parents as a joke. In his closing arguments, Prosecutor Moynihan said that Bob Duke had shoved his wife and child off the cliff and then scrambled down to make sure they were dead. That's how he heard his son's gurgling last breaths, which I would think would be the only way. If he's standing at the top of the cliff, how do you hear him?
Yeah, that's horrible to think about.
Only after he confirmed that they were dead did he call 911. Jury deliberated for 8 hours. The verdict came suddenly late at night, delivered so fast that Roger Brauberger couldn't make it to court on time. As he raced up the courthouse steps, he met Ralph and Rose Davidson, Liana's parents. These parents were clinging to each other, smiling through tears. "Thank you," Ralph Davidson said, grasping Brauberger's hand. "Thank you for coming forward and for doing the right thing."
That must have really been something for him to hear.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So it turns out that Bob Duke was found guilty on all 6 counts.
Okay. Well, sentencing took place in a courtroom that was really packed with family members, witnesses, and investigators. And Larry and Roberta Duke sat in the front, staring straight ahead, silently holding hands. Their older son, Mike, the one who wasn't involved in the plot to kill them, sat beside them. Now, they ignored the stares and the whispered questions that seemed to echo through the court about how they continued to support their sons. How could they do that? I mean, after all, Eric had been their grandson. If he'd killed their own grandson, how could they accept that? So I think that would be, to me, if they realized that he might have killed the grandson and the wife, then they might think, oh, maybe he did try and kill us.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you're in denial at that point, I think that would push you over the edge. But I guess it didn't, or at least publicly, they didn't admit that it did. Now, Liana had really loved them like a daughter. They had a good relationship with her as well. So I kind of feel like sticking by Bob was disrespectful to Liana and Eric, who also loved them.
In the face of all the evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Bob Duke, he shuffled into court. He was wearing an orange jumpsuit and handcuffs, and he even had leg shackles. And reading from a written statement, he spoke of his devotion to his wife and child and how devastated he was that they died. He suggested that he was being punished because he didn't show enough emotion in court and in front of the police officers. And he said, "I'm sorry if my grief did not meet the expectations of the public." So he didn't really accept responsibility.
He didn't get it.
No. Now Roger, he listened, sitting in the back of the courtroom. And until the last minute, he'd been unsure about whether he should even come. He thought he never wanted to see Bob Duke's face again. But his wife Heather, who was expecting their third child by now, persuaded him. "You need to be there," she told him. "You need to feel proud of what you have accomplished here. You need to be there so that someday when your children are old enough, you can tell them how their father had done the right thing." So that was nice.
Good words.
Now, Roger wore a bright yellow coat that day so that if Bob turned around, the first thing he would see would be him. It would catch his attention. He said, "I wanted him to look in my eyes to know that it was over and that he didn't get away with it. I wanted him to know that justice had been done." Now, the judge read the sentence. It was 6 life terms, 4 of them consecutive. And Bob Duke's lawyer immediately said that they were going to appeal, which is no surprise.
No.
But at the back of the courtroom, Roger hugged his wife, Heather. So finally, they felt like they could really move on with their lives and put all this stuff behind them. Roger did stare intently at his former friend, Bob. And Bob was led away, but Bob never turned around and looked at Roger. So for this episode, I'd just like to thank Helen O'Neill because she is an Associated Press writer, and all of her research on the case helped me in this episode. She wrote a series of articles in 2003, which were really great in giving the details of this case. Do you have anything else to say about the case?
No.
Okay.
Simple.
Simple. All right. I still am not sure about this jumping, pushing, falling thing, but no. I'm going to take your word for it.
Okay.
So before we get to feedback, I'd like to take a moment to let all of our listeners know about what's going on now with Team Tie Grabber. We have 4 new full-length episodes on True Crime Brewery's premium feed for members only, and there's much more to come. We recently released an episode on Diane Downs, who was accused of shooting her 3 children because her lover didn't want any kids. This was a fascinating story of a truly deranged woman. And Dick gave us a little talk on histrionic personality disorder in this episode. He was correlating the symptoms with this woman's behavior from childhood, which was really interesting. So this is a case eerily similar also to the case of Susan Smith in our episode titled Forsaken. Now, before that, we covered the Bart Whitaker case about a college student who plotted the murders of his entire family. We also released an episode on the torture and murder of young Sylvia Likens back in the 1960s. And also the milkshake murder of Robert Kissel, a successful businessman poisoned by his wife, which occurred before the violent death of his own brother. And coming up, we have a multiple episode project on the murders of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman in the O.J. Simpson trial. We also have the story of baby Bella Bond, a little girl whose body was found on a Massachusetts beach in 2015. The state investigations into her parents were truly shocking, and we're going to discuss a lot with that. So all of these full-length episodes are yours to listen to by joining Team Tiegrabber at tiegrabber.com. And if you enjoy True Crime Brewery, you might decide that subscribing is a good idea. Also, please don't forget to leave your 5-star review and subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow True Crime Brewery on Twitter at tiegrabberpods, on Instagram, tiegrabberpodcasts, and on Facebook, tiegrabber.com/Facebook. Also, with this summer coming up, it's the perfect time to shop the brewery for a soft, figure-flattering TCB t-shirt.
Oh, that's what I want.
Yeah, so let's have a little music and we'll go to the feedback.
Okay.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs. Redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Welcome to Feedback. And Dick, I'm going to let you go first today.
I get to go first?
You do.
Okay. So Jennifer from Illinois sent us an email with a link to a recent interview with Timothy Pitson's father, Jim Pitson.
Okay, tell us who Timothy Pitson is.
Timothy is the little 6-year-old who's been missing for about 6 years since his mother took him out of school, went on a road trip, and committed suicide. Remember, she left behind a note that Timothy was living with friends of hers and he would never be found.
And that episode was Away From Home.
Right.
Yep.
And the idea is that she killed Timothy.
Well, that's a conclusion that we drew, is that she probably killed him before she killed herself.
Right.
But he hasn't been found.
He hasn't.
No.
His body hasn't been found, and he hasn't been found alive either.
No, he hasn't been found. So his father is still living in limbo.
So father is hoping that he's somehow alive.
Of course, yeah.
So he hops out of the back of the Jeep and runs off to school. And I said, see you later, buddy. He says, love you, Dad. And I go, love you too. So Jim Pitson remembers the last time he would see his little son, Timothy. He ran off to his teacher and it was all good. Later on that morning, when he returned to pick Timothy up, he was gone. I pull in and the teacher says, well, he's not here. And I go, what do you mean he's not here? And she goes, well, he got picked up around 8 or 8:15 in the morning. Timothy checked out of Greenman Elementary School in Aurora, which is about 75 miles away from Rockford. Little did his teachers and classmates know he would never return.
Well, his own mother picked him up, so.
Right.
Who would expect anything to go wrong?
So Jim Pitson goes back to work and says, I need the rest of the day off. Something wrong is going on.
So he knew right away.
Yeah. This was not a usual occurrence, right?
Right.
So Pitson was right. 3 days later, his wife Amy was found dead in a Rockford motel room after she committed suicide. Police later discovered a note she left saying that Timothy was safe with people who love and care for him, and, quote, "you will never find him," end quote. This is a note that still haunts his grieving father today. I was totally taken by surprise by this situation and sort of paralyzed at the time. Timothy's kindergarten teacher, Cheryl Broach, was the last one to see Timothy walk out of school on that day in May in 2011. He was meeting his mother, who volunteered at times in the classroom. So Broach knew something was wrong when Amy, Timothy's mother, didn't notify her that Timothy would be leaving school early.
Okay.
So she's got something out of the ordinary. So he walked down with his backpack on, and he turned at the clock and waved, "See you tomorrow." I said, "See you, Timothy." And he walked away, and I'd never see him again. Wasn't until a few days later that she was told something was wrong. My principal called me into the office and met me in the hallway and told me that there were two police officers in his office and they wanted to talk about Timothy. And right there I lost it. I knew something was wrong, said Broach.
So this is an interview with not just his father, but with his school teacher.
Right.
Okay.
Before Amy was found dead, the two were spotted at Key Lime Cove in Gurnee and the Wisconsin Dells. And later, Amy was seen at the Sullivan's grocery store in Winnebago.
No, she was alone at the grocery store, right?
She was.
Yeah.
But at the Key Lime Cove and the Dells, she was with her son. And we could see them on camera.
We could. There was footage, yeah. Although they didn't really spend a lot of time there, which to be doing, you know, it was like a water park. And they didn't really spend a lot of time there like you would if you wanted to really enjoy it.
No kidding. So Dad says Timothy was the apple of her eye. Timothy made her a better mom. Timothy was the one person she would never do anything to.
Well, I'm afraid he's wrong.
Me too. 6 years later, Aurora police detectives continue to investigate, believing Timothy could still be alive.
He could, but who would have him and not say anything?
Right. So MicroTrace is a private forensic laboratory in Elgin, and they're assisting the Aurora police. They're tracing key evidence, particularly the soil and gravel found under Amy's SUV, which she likely used when Timothy went missing. So Aurora police came to us in this case because they thought perhaps we could put some constraints on where these samples might have come from, or where the dirt might have come from, said the research microscopist. They're looking into a new angle to identify where Timothy may be. There's an unexpected mineral found in the soil called anhydrite. And if we can figure out where this mineral is occurring or why it's occurring in the soil, this could give us information about where the mud originated. Timothy's father is optimistic that investigators will eventually develop a strong lead to bring his son home. He now lives in Clinton, Iowa, with his dog Bailey, who he adopted shortly after Timothy went missing, hoping one day Timothy and Bailey will eventually meet.
Aww.
That's pretty sad.
That's sweet, yeah.
It's terrifying not knowing where he's at. I keep hoping every day that he comes home, says Dad.
Well, I think it's really sad. Like we said in the episode, it seems to us that I think that his mother had the feeling that if she was going to go, he was going to go with her, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
I think it was a murder-suicide.
I think so. I mean,
we have no proof of that, although there was some blood in the back seat of her car.
Right. And not an insubstantial.
No, a fair amount.
A fair amount. So it's not like he had a nosebleed or something like that.
Yeah, and I just think, who would she know that would take him and not ever say anything? Because it seems like the father cared about him. There were aunts and uncles. It wasn't like it was a bad family situation. I think it was just a mom with some severe depression who took him off on her own, unfortunately, and had this bad idea about needing to go with him.
No, I would think if she had given him or sold him or whatever to some people, that we would have heard about it.
But then, on the other hand, if she'd killed him, why haven't any remains been found? That's another thing.
Well, I think you can kill somebody and put their body in a place that it wouldn't get found.
Oh, I mean, gee. Okay. I mean, you're scaring me now.
Well, don't worry. You're safe. But we just read a case, last week's discussion.
About which one?
The little boy in Minnesota or Wisconsin or something, it took him 27 years to find his body.
Oh, right, yeah.
So The fact that they've never found a body,
true,
doesn't tell me anything.
Yeah, I guess that happens. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can find a place to put the body that it won't ever get found, or it won't get found for many, many years.
So I can't decide if that father's better off having hope or having closure. I mean, if they found the body, he could, you know, theoretically have closure and move on. But then on the other hand, I'm like, well, I'd rather let him have some hope.
Well, I would too.
Yeah, I'd rather not know, honestly.
Until they can find a body,
right?
I'm going to be hopeful.
Right, and that's the way to be.
Yeah, what else can you be?
Well, nothing. Okay, thank you, Dickie. So I've had this whole slew of comments from people on YouTube about the Who Killed Nancy Cooper episode. And honestly, that was a long time ago. I didn't remember a lot about it. People will give me comments from an episode we did like 10 months ago or a year ago. It's hard to remember. So I had to kind of rehash it. But here are the comments. One of the person who gave me probably the most comments goes under the name of Wrongful Convictions. And Wrongful Convictions says, "Why do you call it a conspiracy as if they are making it up? It was a fact that tampering was found and a fact that prosecutors withheld the evidence until the privacy policy lapsed. Police verified other insignificant things with Google, but not the smoking gun evidence. You would probably feel differently if this happened to you." Well, I'm sure I would. I mean, anything, you're going to feel differently if it happens to you,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So they say that we're also incorrect about the source of the 23-second limit phone call. It was the prosecution witness who testified to that. And also, Brad's affair was not ongoing. It had ended 2 or 3 months prior to their separation. So it was about this Google Maps search. So Linda on YouTube said that Nancy came home around midnight and she may have had a rendezvous the next morning and was searching the route to the agreed meeting place. But obviously something went wrong at that meeting. And Kimberly on YouTube says, "What's the point of having a chain of custody if the evidence can be used regardless of the fact that the chain was being broken?" So I guess at the heart of this is that there's a large group of people who feel that Brad was wrongly convicted. That's what it comes down to.
Okay.
So I went to the link that Wrongful Convictions gave us, and I ended up buying a Kindle book called Framed, An Examination of the Nancy Cooper Murder Case. So just as a reminder, Nancy Cooper, the wife of Brad Cooper, and the mother of two young daughters, disappeared on July 12, 2008. Brad said he heard her leave the house at 7 a.m. as he was feeding a bottle to their baby girl. And the author of this book, Lynn Blanchard, cites tunnel vision by the police and the prosecution, mishandled evidence, the destruction of evidence, and an inept defense for Brad's conviction. So after winning an appeal for a new trial, Brad took a plea deal for second-degree murder, which gave him an opportunity to be out of prison in as little as 6 years. But if he'd had the retrial, he was afraid that he would be reconvicted because he would have the same judge in the retrial, which I thought was strange that he'd get the same judge.
Yeah.
But that's what they said.
Okay.
And
that,
so he didn't.
That was his fear.
Yeah. So he felt like he wouldn't get a fair trial, so he took the plea.
Well, I guess you could also look at that as, I'll take the plea because I'm guilty anyway and I can get away with it this way.
You can look at it either way. But Lynn Blanchard wrote a whole book about how he was framed. So if you're skeptical about his conviction, that would be something to read that would probably interest you.
I might have to.
And then we also have a voicemail I'd like to play from Gina.
Okay.
Hey guys, my name is Gina, and I am an avid listener, and I love your program. I am also a true crime buff, and I am very interested in The Wrongly Convicted. This is something that's been a passion of mine for many years, and I think primarily that's because we have so many executions in the state of Texas, and sadly, there are people who have been wrongly convicted and later proven innocent beyond a reasonable doubt, fully exonerated, and yet they have served on death row, and one has even been executed. So those cases are Michael Morton, who served 25 years for the murder of his wife. He was initially sentenced to death. It was commuted to life. In his case, he was proven innocent through DNA evidence, and the prosecutor in that case was even convicted because of his misconduct. Another case is Cameron Todd Willingham. He was executed for the murder of his children in an arson, which was later proven to be an accidental fire. It was actually proven prior to his execution, just a few days prior, by the lead arson investigator in the United States, and completely ignored by our governor. And then another case was the case of Carrie Max Cook, and this is someone who went through four trials and was finally released after entering an Alford plea just to not go back to death row because he had so much PTSD from it, and he absolutely did not do the crime. So look into those cases. I think you'd be really interested, and thanks for all you do.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Let's just go through the three that she mentioned as far as wrongly convicted people. We've got Michael Martin, who was wrongly convicted in 1987 for the 1986 murder of his wife, Christine, and he spent 25 years in prison. He was freed in 2011 after he was exonerated by DNA evidence. So DNA linked another man to his wife's murder, and that man was convicted in 2013. And then another one is Cameron Todd Willingham, who was convicted and was actually executed for the murder of his three young children by arson, which she'd mentioned. So there's a 2011 documentary on this one called Incendiary, the Willingham Case. So that might be worth an episode. That's interesting. The fact that he was actually executed is terrifying.
And there is evidence that he didn't do it?
Right.
What kind of evidence?
Well, I don't know.
Oh.
This is a suggestion, so I'm thinking it might be worth watching the documentary.
Yeah, let's do
that. And then maybe do an episode on it.
Could do it.
Okay. Also, another one that she mentioned was Carrie Max Cook, and he served over 20 years for a 1977 rape and murder, and he was released in 2016. And Gina actually sent us the link to an article. And the name of the article is The Trouble with Innocence. So I have that article for us to read. And that might be an interesting one as well. So right. Gina's really into these wrongly convicted, which is interesting because, I mean, like she said, Stephen Avery, that's an interesting one, which we've always thought we might do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't really care too much about Stephen Avery. To me, it's more about the nephew, who I think really got a shitty deal.
He for sure did.
Yeah. So, anyway, let's look into the Cameron Todd Willingham one. Let's watch the documentary, and maybe we'll do that.
I'm with you.
Okay. So that's all I have for feedback this week. It's a light one.
That's good.
You got any feedback for me?
No.
Okay.
I'm feedbacked out.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
Next week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Let's go sample those beers.
Yes, we will.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.